to do that. And because of that, the introduction's going to be necessarily short. I'm sure that very many of you know that Craig Murray was a career politician of some 20 years and actually made a fairly meteoric rise between 1984 and 2002 when he became ambassador to Uzbekistan. It's fairly short, I think, in the same year that Craig turned up in Uzbekistan, the UN rapporteur on torture released a report in which they said that torture and human rights abuses were endemic in the Islam Karimov regime. Craig, as you probably already know, refused to be silenced on the issue. And between 2002 and 2004, incurred the wrath of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. And I'd like, if I may, just, you know, that I say I'm going to make this particularly short, just to read a few sentences from The Guardian that I think encapsulate the story quite well. It says, Murray has paid a more direct price for his decision to step out of the bubble of isolation and immunity in which most diplomats live and to challenge such abuses. His distinctly undiplomatic assessment of Uzbekistan's human rights record propelled him into a lengthy battle with the Foreign Office. He was subjected to a humiliating disciplinary investigation, had his personal life publicly shredded, and suffered a long string of health problems. He became the rogue ambassador, not so much our man in Tashkent as our Uzbekistan problem. Ladies and gentlemen, the man who still refuses to be silenced, Craig Murray.
Thank you. It's very good of you to come out this evening to hear me talk. And a small apology. Normally, it's my practice to give a talk and then adjourn to the pub to discuss things later in more detail of anyone who wants to. Sadly, happily in a sense, I'm off to Ireland to give some talks tomorrow, and I have to get a fairly early flight from Heathrow, so I'm going to be vanishing from Sheffield almost as soon as I finished. So I apologise for that, but I will come back at a later date. Maybe on that occasion we'll just skip the lecture and go straight to the pub, but I'll come back and make up for it. I also want to make one unabashed commercial announcement to get it out of the way, which is this wonderful book, Murder in Samarkand, which I can honestly say is the greatest book I have ever written. Which is on sale normally in the shops for £18.99, and you can get it today at a special price of £19. And I will sign it for you for the extra penny, there you are. But if by the time I finished you feel you want to know more detail and more documentation on what I have to say, please do look at the book. I do realise that £19 is an expensive book, and but I do urge you to look at it anyway. And if you don't want to buy it, please get it from your local library, get it from the university library, and make sure that both your university library and your local library have it. It's actually quite surprised me, to be honest, how few university libraries do stock it, for example. Because I do think, as I hope will become plain when I talk to you, it does contain information which people interested in politics or interested in international law or international relations really did ought to know about the way diplomacy is conducted and about the fundamental roots of the war on terror and some of the means used to conduct the war on terror. And I think the story I have to tell you today boils down perhaps to a lengthy plea for the rule of international law and for adherence to legality in international relations, partly by an example of what happens when you don't. Now let me start off with when I went to Uzbekistan. I was Deputy High Commissioner in Accra, Ghana. This was I was appointed there after, I think, 17 years in the British Foreign Office. I'd previously headed the political and economic sections in the embassy in Poland. And among other jobs, I'd been the head of the FCO section of the Embargo Surveillance Centre, which during the first Gulf crisis was responsible for monitoring Iraqi weapons systems and Iraqi attempts at arms procurement. So I have had I'd had an interesting and varied career. I was in Ghana as Deputy High Commissioner, and I am chiefly an Africanist. My major expertise lies in Africa. And I was telephoned one day by our personnel department, who said, "Craig, would you like to be ambassador in Uzbekistan?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd love to. Why me?" And they said, "Well, you speak Polish." And I said, "Yes, yes, I do, but I don't think the Uzbeks do." And they said, and this is absolutely true, I'm not making this up, they said, "Well, they do speak Russian, and it's the same thing." Which would be great interest to many Polish people, or many Russians. But anyway, I accepted this task, and I headed off, and I arrived in Uzbekistan after a crash course, 6 months learning Russian. I arrived in August of 2002 as British ambassador. I'd only been there a fortnight when I heard that a dissident trial was in progress, which was arousing some interest. Trial of a gentleman called Hudibeganov, Iskander Hudibeganov, who with five others was being accused of a variety of offences, including membership of the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, a group said with some justice to be linked to Al-Qaeda. They also charged with the murder of two policemen, with the armed robbery of a jeweler in order to fund terrorism, and a variety of other crimes. There were six people accused. Not all six were accused of all the crimes. There was a charge sheet of 20-odd crimes. And three of them were accused of this one, five of them of that one, two of that one, all six of this one. It was a kind of mix-and-match charge sheet. And I just thought I'd go along and see what Uzbek justice looked like. One of the first things that surprised me to get there, I met a young man from Human Rights Watch who'd been monitoring the trial, and he said that a large number of people had already been convicted of a murder. Over a dozen other people had already been found guilty of a murder of these policemen. Now, there was no allegation that the policemen had been murdered by a mob or it was a conspiracy. Quite simply, when policemen had been murdered. But when a crime like that occurs, the Uzbek government uses it as an excuse to round up a number of dissidents and convict them and execute them, get some dissidents out of the way. So it's actually perfectly normal in Uzbekistan for several people to be convicted serially of the same crime in order to wipe the slate clean of some of the usual suspects. But it was being in the courtroom was a real eye-opener. I can only compare it to footage I've seen of Hitler's show trials. The judge was screaming and hurling abuse at the accused, mostly of an anti-Islamic nature. And I recall one of the things he said was, "I'm surprised you find time to commit all these crimes when you have to stop to pray five times a day." And this was greeted by laughter in court from the sort of cronies and court officials. And similarly, in the same sort of vein, at one stage he shouted at them, "How could you hear each other talk when you had to talk through those long beards?" Which by this stage had been shaved off, of course, in the prison system. It was just a horrible, weird feeling to be there. The accused were in a cage. They were surrounded by 15 or 16 armed guards. The jeweller who had been robbed had three of the defendants had allegedly robbed this jeweller in order to fund terrorism. He came in. He was terrified. The jeweller was terrified, like everyone else in the court. He was asked to point out the three men who had robbed him. Now, I'm not sure if anyone here is a statistician. I'm not. But the odds against this must be enormous. Out of the six defendants, the jeweller managed to point out the three people who were not accused of robbing him. The judge then screamed and yelled at him, called him a stupid old fool. And the judge read out the names of the three people who were accused of robbing the jeweller and asked them to stand up. The judge then said to the jeweller, "Are these the men?" And the jeweller said, "Yeah." And the judge said, "Let the record show that they were identified." Now I was sitting here thinking, this is getting more and more surreal. But then something happened, which I think was the single incident which did most to lead me on the path that, you know, leads me to be in Sheffield today instead of living in an ambassadorial mansion somewhere. This old man was giving evidence, and he had given a witness statement that two of the accused, who were his nephews, were members of Al-Qaeda and had travelled to Afghanistan, where they had met Osama bin Laden in person. That's what his witness statement said. And he was a very frail old man, a very oriental appearance, long white beard, wearing a traditional quilted Uzbek gown and a lacquered cap. And he was giving his evidence, you know, in a quavering voice, terrified like everyone else in that courtroom. And then suddenly he seemed to find an inner strength and stood much taller. Now, in the Uzbek courtroom, they didn't have a stand for witnesses. People, it was a very, very cramped room indeed, and people who were called to give evidence just stood and gave evidence from where they were sitting. And it happened by chance that this guy was sitting immediately in front of me. I could have touched him easily as he was speaking. And he stood up and he said in a much louder voice, he said, "This is not true. It is not true. They tortured my children in front of me until I signed this statement. We are poor farmers from Andijan. We are good Muslims, but what do we know about Osama bin Laden?" And it's hard to explain because it's partly intuitive. It's not entirely objective. But being so close to him and hearing him say that at that moment, you could just tell that that was the truth, that now he was speaking the truth. And he must have known that in saying that, he was almost certainly signing his own death warrant. It was a very, very striking occasion. Anyway, he was hustled out of the court, and the court finished for that day. I didn't actually go back, I didn't need to go back and witness any more of the trial myself. And at the end of it, people were sentenced to death. Well, not all of the defendants, some of them were sentenced to life imprisonment. But that led me thinking, because I was under a standing instruction as British ambassador. I was under a direct instruction that every time I spoke in public, I was always to thank Uzbekistan. First thing I had to say all the time was to thank Uzbekistan for its role in supporting the alliance in the war on terror and for its position as part of the coalition of the willing. Uzbekistan had sent a small contingent to Iraq and was meant to be on the front line of fighting against Al-Qaeda. News got around that I'd been to this trial and that the British ambassador was taking an interest in human rights, which thankfully came as rather a surprise to people, because certainly since September 11th, when Uzbekistan joined the, shortly thereafter joined the coalition of the willing, the West had paid no attention at all to human rights abuses in Uzbekistan. It came as rather a surprise that I did. And people started to beat a path to my door, because the Uzbeks are a terrifically oppressed people. And really, they had nowhere to turn. They started to beat a path to my door, and we started meeting more and more victims of torture. People came to me who'd been tortured themselves. The families of victims of torture came. People with photographic evidence of torture came. And I received letters smuggled out of the prisons and gulags. And there are over 10,000 political and religious prisoners in Uzbekistan, people held for their beliefs. And we began to build up a picture of torture practiced on an industrial scale, torture affecting thousands of people every year. One of the very first things that happened almost immediately after that trial, as in, I believe it actually was the next day, I mean, it really was extremely soon, was that an old lady brought in photographs of a body. This gentleman, his name was Muzaffar Avazov, had been a prisoner in the Jazlik Gulag, was the lady's son, and his body had been returned to her in a sealed casket. She'd been ordered to bury the body the next day and not to open the casket. Now, she had opened the casket because she felt she had certain religious duties to perform by way of washing the corpse. And she got it out and she took photographs of the body, which is in a very bad condition. When I saw the photographs, I couldn't work out what had happened. because I'd never seen anything like it. So we sent the photographs to the University of Glasgow Pathology Department. And they sent back a report saying that his fingernails had been pulled out, he'd been beaten about the face and the neck, and that he died of immersion in boiling liquid. And it was immersion, not splashing, because there was a clear tide line around the upper torso and the upper limbs. And I was stunned. I mean, he'd been boiled alive. And that, I think, gives you some idea, you know, when I say torture, the kind of thing I mean. Immersion of limbs in liquid was quite common, although immersion of the whole body was unusual. But rape was very frequent. The torture of children in front of their parents turned out to be something that happens a lot. None of these circumstances, of course, people will confess to anything. But as we were building up this dossier about torture in Uzbekistan, we also started to learn more and more about what people were being forced to confess to under torture. And under that kind of torture, as I said, pretty well anyone will confess to anything, especially if it's your children being tortured and not you. And what people were confessing to routinely was membership of Al-Qaeda, was visiting Afghanistan, personal meetings with Osama bin Laden, and people also were frequently signing up to lists of people who they named as also members of Al-Qaeda. Long lists of people, 12 people, 20 people. Very often, the person signing had never heard of anyone on these lists at all. But under torture, they would sign and say, yeah, I'm in Al-Qaeda, and they all are too. And these people, and the people signing, by and large, didn't know. They could be in Uzbekistan, they could be in the UK, they could be anywhere. At the same time that this was happening, I was receiving the CIA intelligence coming out of Uzbekistan, which was given to the CIA by the Uzbek security services. That was plain from the material itself. I received the CIA material under the UK-US intelligence sharing agreement, by which CIA and MI6 share all their intelligence, as do GCHQ and the NSA. And the existence of the UK-US intelligence sharing agreement is viewed as a fundamental foreign policy factor by the UK. Minister, I can't overrate how highly ministers praise it, and that becomes very important as I go on in the story. It's viewed as important as the Trident missile agreement, because the CIA give us three times as much intelligence as we give them. Now, Uzbekistan was a good case in point. I didn't give them anything because I didn't have an MI6 station in Tashkent. Now, I don't want to spoil anybody's enjoyment of James Bond films, but there was no MI6 station in Tashkent because it was too dangerous. Now, in fact, forget James Bond, okay? MI6 do not serve in countries where you can't buy a cappuccino. That's a kind of general rule. I didn't have an MI6 station, but the CIA had a large station. I was getting their intelligence. And their intelligence was saying all the same things. It was saying that lots of lists of people were members of Al-Qaeda. It was saying that people had traveled to Afghanistan and met Osama bin Laden in person. And a lot of it was just demonstrably false. I knew it was wrong. You know, from our own sources of information, we knew this intelligence was untrue. People asked me how. Well, let me give you a couple of examples. There was intelligence about a large Al-Qaeda training camp just over the border in Tajikistan, in the hills overlooking Samarkand, from where Al-Qaeda were supposed to be going to swoop down and physically take the city of Samarkand. Now, my defense attaché, Colonel Vidat, had actually visited that precise location, and there was nothing there. Just physically didn't exist, this camp. My favorite example was of usually these people, the majority of people named as Al-Qaeda members in the intelligence were usually just members of the Uzbek Democratic Opposition. Now, I should explain that Uzbekistan is a totalitarian state. It's not an authoritarian state, it's a totalitarian state. The government aspires to control all aspects of not just the political and social lives, but the commercial and economic life of the people. The majority of people still work on state farms. Over 60% of the population are tied to state farms. And they live in conditions of serfdom in a very literal sense. They are not allowed to leave. Uzbekistan is the world's second largest exporter of cotton. It's only the fourth or fifth largest producer, but as it doesn't use much internally, it's the second largest exporter. It makes it a major, major factor on the world cotton market. And the reason the Aral Sea is disappearing is that the water is all being taken out to irrigate many millions of hectares of cotton in what were the deserts of Central Asia. The cotton is picked nowadays, in Soviet times, about 90% was actually picked by machine. Nowadays, over 95% of it is picked by hand. Because the Uzbek leadership worked out that they got a lot of people that they don't have to pay for, whereas machines cost money. You need a huge labour force to pick cotton on that scale. And you really are talking about the precise system that was used in the plantations of the United States in the 19th century. 60% of the workforce are tied to the state farms, and they're tied because Uzbekistan still has an internal visa system. If you want to move from one town to another town in Uzbekistan, you need a propusk. You can't physically... There are roadblocks on literally every road in the country. Every junction, every street corner has policemen. Tashkent City alone, and it's a city of some 2 million people, Tashkent City alone has 40,000 uniformed policemen. That's bigger than the Met. And it has more than that, 50 or 60,000, from the SNB and MVD, the non-uniformed secret police. On top of which, there are Mahalla committees, which effectively administer and spy on the inhabitants of every district. And they have the ability, it's an extremely efficient totalitarian state. I'd lived in dictatorships before. I'd lived in Nigeria under Babangida and the Abacha, for example. That was a dictatorship tempered by inefficiency. Whereas in Uzbekistan, it's actually a very, very efficient system. And they have the ability to police it. And you cannot leave. If you're a cotton farmer, you will never get the propusk or the to move or the police resident permit to live in another town. You are stuck on that cotton farm, picking cotton for the rest of your life. There's no opposition allowed. The opposition political parties are banned. They're not allowed to take part in elections at all. There's absolutely no freedom of the media. There's no freedom of assembly. There's no freedom of religion. There's a state-sanctioned Islamic church, which is precisely... Church isn't the word, sorry. Islamic organization, which is precisely the same. As almost all the institutions of Uzbekistan haven't changed at all since Soviet times. And the leadership, President Karimov, was president of the Uzbek Soviet Socialist Republic. What's been added is an extra layer of cruelty and an extra layer of corruption. And there's plenty of those in the Soviet system. It's got worse. So there's a lot of opposition, pent-up opposition, which doesn't have any outlet. And there are a lot of people who try to be... There are a lot of people who were dissidents in Soviet times and who remain dissidents nowadays. And the purpose of much of this intelligence from the Uzbek government is to name those people who are in the opposition, in democratic opposition, people who want more economic freedom, to name them all as members of Al-Qaeda. Whereas, in fact, mostly they're not. Mostly they're just people who are fed up being slaves, in effect. And sometimes, you know, the intelligence is demonstrably nonsense. And my favorite was bit of CIA intelligence on a prominent Uzbek dissident who was named as a member of Al-Qaeda, and I know the man, and he's a Jehovah's Witness. Now, there are not many Jehovah's Witnesses in Al-Qaeda. In fact, I would venture to guess that Al-Qaeda don't even try to recruit Jehovah's Witnesses. I'm sure that doesn't work the other way. I'm sure the Jehovah's Witnesses would try to recruit Al-Qaeda if they knew where they were. They'd be knocking on that cave door with the watchtower. But I didn't regard it as terribly plausible that this Jehovah's Witness was an Al-Qaeda member. And much of the CIA intelligence wasn't plausible, and it was obviously just stuff passed on by the Uzbeks to the CIA in a self-serving way to portray the Uzbek opposition as Al-Qaeda, and the CIA putting it out as true. And I worried about this a lot, because it seemed to me that the material was coming from the torture chambers, and it was wrong. And I sent back, first in November of 2002, and again in either late January or early February 2003, I sent back a diplomatic telegram, we still call our formal communications telegrams, to London, stating that we were getting intelligence from torture, that this was illegal in terms of the UN Convention Against Torture. It was immoral for reasons that were obvious, and it was impractical because the material that was wrong. I didn't receive a direct response from the Foreign Office, but I did receive a letter telling me, and I think this is wonderful, the Foreign Office was becoming concerned that I was, and this is a quote, I was over-focused on human rights. The Foreign Office was worried about my excessive focus on human rights. I sent my deputy to the US Embassy to say to them, we're worried that this intelligence material comes from torture. Do you have anything in place to make sure it doesn't? Just to make sure I was not making a fool of myself. She came back and said that the American Embassy had reported that yes, it probably does come from torture, but no, we don't see that as a problem in the context of a war on terror. I did see it as a problem, so I kept complaining. And then in early March of 2006, I was summoned back to the Foreign Office for a meeting, which took place on either the 7th or the 8th of March. And it took place in the FCO itself, and I was aware I was being called back to be carpeted. And at that meeting, I was told three things. Firstly, I was told by Sir Michael Wood, the Foreign Office's chief legal advisor. Michael Wood told me that it was not illegal for us to obtain intelligence under torture. He said, it's not illegal for us to obtain intelligence under torture, provided two things. Provided, firstly, that we don't do the torturing ourselves. As long as we don't do the torturing ourselves, it's not illegal. And as long as we don't specifically request that a named individual be tortured. And that was his view, based on his reading of the UN Convention Against Torture. And I'll come on to whether his reading's right or not later on. The second thing I was told was that, as a matter of policy, Jack Straw had met Sir Richard Dearlove, the head of MI6, and they had decided that, as a matter of policy, we should use intelligence obtained under torture in the war on terror, that it was necessary to pursue the war on terror to use intelligence obtained by torture. Now, both of those I'll come back to later, and I think they are very important. But the third thing, I think, is still more important. It doesn't sound it at first, but I want you to think through its ramifications. And I kept saying, but the intelligence is untrue. And they kept replying. There's a gentleman representing MI6 whose name was Matthew Kidd. Now, he was the head of something called Whitehall Liaison Department, which is the link between the Foreign Office, MI5, and MI6. The person who's the head of that department could be from MI5, MI6, or the FCO. And I genuinely don't actually know which one Matthew Kidd is. But he was representing the security services, and he was speaking very carefully from a written brief, which he had in front of him. And every time I said, this material is untrue, he would reply, but it's operationally useful. And he was using that phrase very carefully. I'd say, but it's nonsense. You know, it's fabrication, it's lies. And he'd say, it's operationally useful. And I want you to take that concept and think about it. That intelligence is now judged for value, not on is it true or not, which is how we actually used to judge intelligence, but is it useful or not to our operations? And I want you to apply that concept to the intelligence on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. Was it true? No, it was completely untrue. Was it operationally useful? Yeah, it was the most operationally useful material they ever had, because it enabled them to construct a legal argument that a war was legal, which otherwise was obviously completely illegal, to claim imminent threat and self-protection, in effect. And that's very scary, that the value of intelligence now is, does it justify the policy we are pursuing, not is it true? And this leads to some interesting questions. I mean, people ask me, say to me, for example, if that is true, why don't they just make it up? Why do they have to torture people? Well, the thing about intelligence is it's not an exact science. You're always getting an awful lot of information in. There are two basic forms of intelligence. Communications intelligence, which comes basically from GCHQ and NSA, but some may come from MI5, and human intelligence, which abroad comes from MI6, at home from MI5. Communications intelligence is what it is. It's a transcript of people speaking, and you have to work out whether you believe it or not. Normally, it's very reliable. The only question is whether people aware that they are being tapped are saying misleading stuff, and you have to bear that in your analysis. with human intelligence, which is stuff that somebody has told you, you have to decide, do you believe them or not? Which is not an exact science. You have to consider, what are their motives for telling me? The most important question to ask is, which is the first question that the intelligence services ask, is what they call access, which is, does this person have the ability to know this? For example, you know, if one of the people in the audience told me about the precise location of Iranian plutonium processing facilities, I might doubt your access, as in, do you have the ability to know that information? Then the second thing you have to judge is reliability, which is, are you telling me the truth or are you deliberately misleading me? And if so, why? So it's not an exact science. Those are all judgments you have to make. Some intelligence is obtained under torture, as we've seen from Uzbekistan. In the case of the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, there were two main areas of intelligence. There were several, but two main areas of intelligence went into the dossier on weapons of mass destruction. The first was stuff which was presented by Chalabi, the American client from the Iraqi gangster opposition movement, I suppose, best characterized, who was living in the United States, who hoped to be parachuted in and made president of Iraq. Now, he had an obvious motive for painting the situation in such a way that would justify an invasion. So his reliability could have been doubted, and his access could have been doubted as well, because how good Chalabi's links really were into the Iraqi military and the people in charge of their weapon systems was much open to doubt. But they chose to believe him. They chose to believe him because it suited the policy. But the second, and actually the bulk of information, came from the old-fashioned way, which is the way that the majority of MI6 intelligence comes, which is from buying it. Most of the intelligence in that dossier on weapons of mass destruction came from senior Iraqi military, well, middle ranking to senior, not above colonel, as I understand it, who were met in Egyptian hotel rooms and were handed over suitcases full of money. Here's $1 million in new notes. Tell me about weapons of mass destruction. Your average Iraqi colonel, if you give him $1 million in used notes, will tell you about weapons of mass destruction, all kinds of stuff. And again, you can choose whether to believe it or not. And they decided to give credence to it. And now what I'm telling you is that, and from my direct experience in Uzbekistan, the situation has become perverted so that people will give credence to stuff that's not worthy of credence if it fits the ministerial policy. And I believe that's also what happened in Iraq. Why did it happen in Uzbekistan? Well, the Americans were backing Karimov. Karimov is, by any accounts, one of the worst dictators in the world. There's an American magazine called Parade, which isn't generally very notable, but it every year it conducts a survey of the world's worst dictators, and it consults Freedom House and Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International and various people, and gets them to give their scores, and then it compiles a sort of Eurovision Song Contest winning sheet. And according to Parade magazine this year, President Karimov of Uzbekistan is the world's fifth worst dictator. Now, if you were to say to me, really he's the third or really he's the tenth, I wouldn't argue. I mean, it doesn't make much difference. But he is, by any account, one of the worst dictators in the world. And yet the United States were justifying him. They were embracing him as a partner in the war on terror. In the year 2002 alone, and this is according to a local press release put out by the United States Embassy in December of 2002, the United States gave over $500 million in aid to the Karimov regime. And to put that in perspective, that's more aid than USAID gave to West Africa. $500 million. Of that, $120 million went straight to the US to the Uzbek armed services, and over $80 million went to the Uzbek security services, the people who were boiling people to death and otherwise torturing them. Now, how on earth do you justify that kind of aid to a dictator? Well, by making him part of the war on terror, part of the coalition of the willing, by fighting a common enemy. And you justify his dictatorship on the grounds that the people he's keeping down, who may look like Democrats, are not really Democrats or political opponents, they're actually Al-Qaeda, even though they're not. And I should say that Islamic fundamentalism in Uzbekistan is extremely small. The majority of people, probably 80%, are Muslim. But they do not, by any means, embrace fundamentalism. And until we started backing the dictator, they were very well disposed towards the west, rather less disposed, well disposed now. But if you were, for example, and I've been all over Uzbekistan, as you can read in this excellent book, and spoken to many people. I have hundreds of Uzbek friends, many of whom would like to see a more religious, you know, they would like to be able to practice their religion. For example, if you keep Ramadan and fast during the daytime, if you pray five times a day, both of those are enough to get you suspected as a religious fanatic and bunged into jail. They would like to have the freedom to practice religion that they want, but if you were to have a referendum on Sharia law, I've got no doubt whatsoever that 95% of Uzbek people at least would vote against Sharia law. And if you were to explain clearly to everyone that under Sharia law you can't drink vodka, 99% of Uzbek people would vote against it. Because of all the Uzbeks I know, and I know hundreds, I can only think of one who doesn't drink vodka, including many, many good Muslims. So they have a they have, incidentally, I just tell you this for anthropological reasons rather than anything else, but I think it's fascinating. They have a local tradition that if you drink vodka, you can remove the sin by eating fish afterwards, which is fascinating. I'm also told it works for sex as well, incidentally. I get a guild of fishmongers to popularise that one here. So why were the United States backing this dictator? Why did they want to do this? You know, what was the whole purpose of it? Well, a large part of the purpose is explained in a letter that you'll find in facsimile here. This letter is dated the 3rd of April 1997. Remember that? 1997. 4.5 years before September the 11th. And it was written to George Bush while he was governor of Texas. It's probably too small for you to see the company logo. It's from a company called Enron. And the letter's from Mr. Kenneth L. Lay, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Enron. And it starts, dated 3rd of April 1997, it starts, it did start originally, Dear Governor Bush. And then Kenneth Lay scratched that out and put Dear George in his own handwriting, which is fascinating because we learned at the time of Kenneth Lay's trial that George Bush hardly knew him. And it's, you'll be meeting with Ambassador Sadiq Safaya, Uzbekistan's ambassador to the United States, on April the 8th. Ambassador Safaya has been foreign minister, blah, blah. Enron has established an office in Tashkent, and we are negotiating a $2 billion joint venture with Nefty Gas of Uzbekistan and Gazprom of Russia to develop Uzbekistan's natural gas and transport it to markets. And it finishes up. I know you and Ambassador Safayev will have a productive meeting which will result in a friendship between Texas and Uzbekistan. And that $2 billion contract was just a foot in the door. It was a small contract to get into Central Asia's gas market. Central Asia has the largest untapped source of hydrocarbons in the world. Biggest hydrocarbon reserves left anywhere are in Central Asia. So large that a lot of them are still not properly explored. There was a long-running attempt to develop a pipeline over Afghanistan down to the Arabian Sea to get them out, because the problem is they're in Central Asia, they're locked in, there's no way out other than through Russia, which we met, and the Americans were desperate to get those hydrocarbon reserves away from Russian control. And that's what so much of this was actually about at the end of the day. It was about access to the hydrocarbons. For access to the hydrocarbons, you've got two choices. When you have a dictator, be he Saddam Hussein or Karimov, who won't give you access to the hydrocarbons, you can either butter him up and bribe him and go along with him, or you can get rid of him. In Saddam Hussein's case, they went on the get rid of him route. In the Karimov route, they found he was amenable, Enron found he was amenable. That Enron paid Karimov's daughter $100 million in order to facilitate their entry into Central Asia. When Enron went bust, which is when I was there, by the time I turned up in August 2002, Enron had just gone broke, and it was all up to play for again. The Americans were desperate to get back into those oil and gas contracts. The Americans were saying to Karimov, we've got Exxon, we've got Texaco, you can take over, they can take over the contract. Karimov was saying, that's fine, but there is no contract anymore. The contract was with Enron, which is a bankrupt entity. If you want a new contract, of course, someone's going to have to stump up for my daughter again. And although I have no time for either Exxon or Texaco, but unlike Enron, they are not stupid enough to pay out $100 million in bribes to a mad dictator. So in the end, strangely, it was Gazprom who actually, eventually, in November, the deal was concluded in November of 2004, though it had been negotiated some time earlier. It was Gazprom who got the gas reserve, the gas deal, excluding the United States, after all of this, and after all that American aid money was paid. The Americans had had an air base in Uzbekistan, in Kashi-Karnabad. Gazprom paid $88 million to the president's daughter in a deal negotiated by the external affairs director of Gazprom, who's a man, a native Uzbek, called Alisher Usmanov. As part of that deal, because Gazprom's a state company and was paying $88 million of state money to the Karimov family, as part of that deal, Putin insisted that the American airbase be kicked out of Uzbekistan, as it was. The Americans tried to cover up their retreat by pretending that this was in reaction to the American protest at the Andijan massacre, which is most unlikely, as the Americans hadn't really made a protest at the Andijan massacre. In fact, it was about the oil and gas. And in the end, the Americans actually lost out on that particular bit of great game politics, and they're no longer in Uzbekistan. So a sort of muddy story of how the truth behind, and in my 21 years experience in the Foreign Service, not unusual at all, but the truth behind the surface diplomacy comes down to hard-nosed commercial interests and specific commercial interests which are close to the administration. That almost always is the case. That what you see isn't what you get, that the war on terror in Central Asia is largely invented, the Islamic militancy in Central Asia massively inflated, the power and size of Al-Qaeda in Uzbekistan massively inflated, and I would say to you, I have no doubt that the power and influence of Al-Qaeda everywhere is massively inflated by those who benefit from the continual pursuance of the war on terror. And from what I've told you about intelligence and the little value placed on whether the intelligence from Uzbekistan was true or not, I want you in general to start being skeptical when you hear things are based on intelligence. When police raid, 270 policemen raid a house in Forest Gate and shoot a postman, that was based on intelligence. I don't know, do you remember the ricin plot where we were all going to die of ricin poisoning? These deadly Muslims were making ricin. There are two things you have to know about the ricin plot. Firstly, there was no ricin, and secondly, there was no plot. Because despite the fact that the police announced formally in a press conference they had found ricin, the jury found they hadn't found ricin. In fact, the amount of ricin they had found was precisely the amount which is in everybody's kitchen, because it's a naturally occurring substance. And almost certainly all of our kitchens contain a little ricin. No one's ever actually died of ricin poisoning, except for poor old, I think it was Makarov, his name. Do you remember the Bulgarian dissident who was stabbed with an umbrella? That was ricin. And actually the only way, really, definitely to poison someone with ricin is to inject it into their bloodstream. If you ingested it, the alleged plot to pour it into reservoirs definitely would might have caused the odd wobbly tummy. It was unlikely to kill anyone, certainly on a mass scale. Now, that was all based on intelligence from Algeria. Intelligence which the government, in a strange way, admitted was obtained under torture. Because in November of last year, the government was arguing before the House of Lords for the right to use evidence from torture in British courts. I'll say that again, because it's astonishing. And if I'd said it to anyone 10 years ago and predicted it, you would have thought I was totally mad. In November last year, the government argued before the House of Lords for the right to use evidence from torture in British courts. Thank God the House of Lords, or the Law Lords, hadn't totally taken leave of their senses and they turned the government down. But one of the arguments put forward was in a deposition by Eliza Manningham Buller, the head of MI5. And in her deposition, she said that the ricin plot had only been foiled because of intelligence from Algeria, and the intelligence came from someone from, I can't remember the precise phrase he used, it's something like robust interrogation techniques in Algeria. I think we know what that means. So the argument, you know, torture works. Torturing people's great. You know, led us to break up with ricin. But trouble is, there wasn't any ricin. Now, in fact, a policeman got killed, sadly, when they burst into the apartment. One of the inhabitants of the apartment, who had a history of mental illness, stabbed the policeman. That's obviously a terrible, terrible thing. But if you, you know, break in the middle of the night into the apartment of someone who's mentally ill, it's a sort of terrible accident likely to happen. But it didn't indicate any link with terrorism, and certainly there was no ricin. There was none. And all the people who were charged with conspiracy, the residents of that flat and others, were all found not guilty. Now, how many of us saw that in the papers when they were found not guilty? Now, I'm quite certain that pretty well everyone in this room saw the ricin plot at the time the police were alleging it, because it was front page news, and it was first item on the television news for several days. In fact, Colin Powell, because this happened between 9/11 and the actual outbreak of war in Iraq, Colin Powell actually cited the ricin plot, which didn't exist, before the UN Security Council as part of the evidence of Iraq's network of terrorism. Didn't actually exist. When they were found not guilty, did that make it onto the front pages of the paper? No. Probably made it into, you know, half a paragraph on page 24. There's so much that comes from intelligence which turns out not to be the case. I'm personally deeply sceptical. There may be a germ of something. Terrorism exists. Islamic terrorism exists. Other forms of terrorism exist. But Islamic terrorism exists. It's perfectly possible that in the latest high-profile one, there were some people who did believe they were going to try to blow up planes over mid-Atlantic. Was it really practical to mix liquid explosives in a plane toilet? Was it really imminent? Was it really bigger than 9/11? Did it really involve 10 aeroplanes? I strongly suspect we'll find almost all of that to be untrue. I won't know, because we won't know for another 2 years. And if they're found not guilty, you'll hardly know at all, because it'll be on page 25. If they're found guilty, it'll be all over page one for weeks on end again. But remember, the people... I mention all this all to you because all of those were sourced to intelligence. Forest Gate, ricin, bombs over the Atlantic. All sourced to intelligence. And remember that the intelligence is judged not on whether it's true or not, but whether it's operationally useful. And be sceptical. Be sceptical about a lot you hear in the war on terror. Remember that I can testify firsthand to a definite tendency to exaggerate the size of Al-Qaeda and exaggerate the extent of terrorism. And they had a reason to do that in Uzbekistan. Question whether they have a reason to do it here. And think about how the threat of terrorism is used to help spread Islamophobia. I couldn't believe last week. Last week I couldn't believe the country I was living in. Every single day there was a new story about Muslims. First of all, it was the Muslim who refused the Israeli embassy. Then it was the Muslim deity in Windsor where they were building an unauthorized mosque. Then it was the Muslim cabbie who refused to allow a guide dog into the back of his car. Then it was Jack Straw's views on how women should dress. Every day, front page headline, demonizing Muslims. We're being driven into a state of fear by this constant exaggeration of the capability and resource of Al-Qaeda, into a state of fear where we accept any story about Muslims as genuine, legitimate front-page news. And personally, I think the Muslim taxi driver who apparently did indeed refuse to let a guide dog into the back of his cab was behaving like a complete and utter idiot. And I know very many Muslims who feel exactly the same way. You know, he was wrong. But is it actually front page news? Had no non-Muslim done anything worse than that on that day? You know, was there actually no murder committed in the UK that week by someone? You know, is that not worse than not letting a guide dog in the back of your cab? It's bad, but if it hadn't been a Muslim, would it have got into the... Would it have been front page news? No, this... And the deity building a mosque without planning permission. How many... actually, just down the road from that, on the Sunningdale Golf Course, a Grade 2 listed building has just been knocked down by a property developer. That's actually rather worse than building a mosque in many ways. Was that front page news? No, guy wasn't a Muslim. If he'd been a Muslim, I expect it would have been front page news. How have we got to the stage where rampantly racist, there's no other word to it, headlines are becoming acceptable and the norm and no one questions them? How have we been driven? Because of the exaggeration of the threat, we're all made to live in this state of fear by this false intelligence about Al-Qaeda going to kill us every day. You have, by any calculation means, and it depends, of course, where your baseline is. Do you just take last year when we had 7/7? Do you take a 5-year period? Do you take a 10-year period? But however you calculate it, we all have at least 100 times more chance of being killed by a car than being killed by a terrorist. You even have a statistically significantly greater chance of drowning in your own bath than being killed by a terrorist. And yet we're subjected to this appalling Islamophobia. And part of the reason is that by demonizing Muslims, you don't care so much about them. When 100,000 of them were killed in Iraq, or you know, several thousand of them were killed in Lebanon, or in Afghanistan, or maybe next in Iran. And partly it's so that we accept that we're all in this dreadful danger, we need to have our own civil liberties taken away from us to restrict our rights to protest. And I want to come back to this question of morality and the war on terror and legality, and that question of torture. And to the idea that it's okay to torture Muslims. You know, you've boiled the guy alive, you've cut his bollocks off, but he was only a Muslim. Doesn't matter. The idea that, you know, Sir Michael Wood, as long as we don't do the torturing ourselves or specifically request that a named individual be tortured, it's legal for us to get the intelligence from it. That people's children are being tortured in front of their eyes and we don't see a moral problem. The torture works argument is accepted. John Reed, the United States has just passed, the Congress has just passed a bill legalizing torture, legalizing robust interrogation techniques, and arguing that the president can, by executive order, overrule the Geneva Convention, which is international law. The president can overrule it. If we come down to what the UN Convention Against Torture says, Sir Michael Wood is the only international lawyer I know who holds that as long as we don't do the torturing ourselves, it's legal. Because Article 4 of the UN Convention specifically bans complicity in torture. And if we're knowingly and continually getting stuff from torture, are we not complicit? Of course we are. It's you can compare it to receiving stolen goods. Let's say a guy comes and offers you a new colour television, brand new, never used, for £10. And the next day, and the next day, and the next day, he comes and gives you another, until you've accepted several thousand of them. And you say, well, I didn't steal them myself, I didn't know they were stolen, how did I know? Well, a policeman's not going to buy that. And similarly, if we keep getting intelligence material from Uzbekistan, from Algeria, from Morocco, are we not complicit? We are complicit. But the moral case is still stronger. And it seems to me that something has happened in the war on terror where we have been terrified into a situation where society has absolutely lost its moral values. To me, you know, having 5 days in a row where the front page headlines in all the newspaper stories were anti-Muslim stories based on small incidents. That's not the country I recognise. A country where the government goes to the House of Lords for the right to use evidence from torture in court. Something that was abolished by James VI and First. That's not the country I recognise. I was a British diplomat for 21 years. And it reached the stage where I didn't want to represent this country anymore. Now I'm devoting myself to going around and attempt, I suppose, to bring home the reality of some of this, because we read it in the paper. You read about robust interrogation techniques in the paper. What does it mean? It means people's children being tortured in front of them. Wake up to what's happening, because we're on a slippery slide. Now I want to leave you with one last thought. When I walked into that room, when I'd been summoned for this meeting about torture and intelligence, and I knew I was in trouble, I saw Sir Michael Wood sitting there. Now, I'd known Sir Michael Wood for over 20 years. He's a really, really nice man, very nice man indeed. And I saw him, and I thought, oh, there's Michael. Michael will be against torture. That's great. I've got an ally. And when he started going on about, well, it could be legal as long as we don't do it, I just looked at him in astonishment. And at that moment, I honestly think I understood how in Germany, a civil servant who was a nice guy, who was kind to his kids, good to his neighbours, could be ordering cattle trucks to go to Auschwitz and think, I'm only doing my job. And I'm really, really scared that that's the direction this country's heading. Thank you.
I suppose.